Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer. SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting.
Than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience.
With Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I'm Anna Garcia, host of True Crime News, the podcast. Every week, we bring you in-depth coverage on cases making headlines, as well as those that go under the radar. Tune in for Murders That Defy Explanation, Mystery Seeking Exploration, and Shocking Secrets That Will Leave You Breathless. Each week, we honor the victims by going beyond the salacious in our search for justice. Crime never stops. And neither do we. Listen to True Crime News, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1919, he hit 29 home runs and was sold to the New York Yankees.
A three-run home run for Buffington. The Yankees now lead by a score of 3-2. Bill Lee is now going over to a couple of the Yankees, and there they go again.
And hits it to deep left. That might send the Yankees to the World Series.
Veritek and A-Rod go. Roberts is going. Posada's throw. Roberts, safe.
What can I say? Just dip my heart and call the Yankees my daddy.
Welcome to Fanbase, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. I'm Brian Shackman. He's John Senecal. This is episode 46. I mean, John, I'm sort of dedicating this episode to you.
To me or yes. To Derek Jeter? We got to
I should say episode two, yep. Right? But we're going to talk about Jeter to start, and then we're going to sort of put the current affairs into place and sort of project what's happening, because both the Red Sox and Yankees are in a little bit of trouble, but you can be optimistic or pessimistic based on what's ahead. And then I want to get some stuff from you on 9/11, because you both were in Manhattan on 9/11 and covered that World Series the best you could. So, you know, it's just a lot to digest here in episode 46. But I do want to start with, I mean, the Hall of Fame, you know, it didn't have a ceremony last year. Yesterday was mildly annoying for me to see all the number two jerseys. I mean, it's kind of cute to see a grandfather with number two shirt and a son with the number two shirt and his grandson with a number two shirt. But at the same time, it's cool for the people who love those fans. So, like, you didn't go. First of all, I want to ask you, why didn't you go?
I mean, it's just not the good time of year for me to go, you know, with the kids and everything, and, you know, they're in
school.
So
you wouldn't pluck them out of school and just
make it? If it was over the summer, the plan was to go. Okay. If it was normally when it was in July, the plan was to go. But I did watch it, and it was great. I mean, you talk about the jerseys and all that, and it's just, you know, he's a guy who transcends sports, you know.
You really think so?
Yes, because he's got plays named after him, you know. He's got the flip play. Like, how many other players have that? You know, Willie Mays has the catch, Doug Flutie's got the Hail Mary.
Jordan with the dunk,
and then, you know, the tongue out. You know, it goes beyond baseball with Derek Jeter. And, you know, you say he's too dry, but, you know, I say there's nothing wrong with that.
He's boring.
Right, he's boring, but there's nothing wrong with being boring. And the amazing thing is, which is even more amazing, is the guy absolutely figured out how to do it in New York City, too, Yankees.
I go back to that. I mean, let's face it, he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. I don't care. This whole debate about unanimous or not is such a garbage argument.
It was nice that he took a shot at the one writer.
Right, whoever that person may be, and I wonder who it actually was. But I do think that you make a good point, because New York kills people. I mean, it can really, the pressure can get you.
You could be the best player in the world and
you
show
go there
up in
and
New
all
York.
Of a sudden it just reduces you. And Boston can chew people up, but it's different. Boston, it's the media, but it's in New York for some reason, I don't know. It's just, to me, it's more about the media and the fans, but also just the distraction of New York itself. It takes people in and they have too much fun or whatever. Right. Like, it's
they
not
get lost
just
in New York.
Yeah, it's not just about the media and the fans getting it. We're in Boston, it's the media and the fans, but the city itself is just like another city. And if you're a person of color, Boston's not a fun place for many of them. But in New York, it's, you got money and you have options, and then you all of a sudden you're
mediocre. When you're the toast of the town, everything's getting thrown at you.
But he was able, in the hardest place to play to be the best right. in the hardest place to play, which I do have to give him respect. And it's not even necessarily begrudging, but, you know, it just made me think about those Yankee teams. And, yeah, I mean, he was boring, but I just wished, you know, did he go off script at all? Did he do anything that wasn't perfect in that speech?
It was... No, I mean, he, other than taking the shot at the writer, I mean, no, he didn't go off script. You know, he thanked the right people. I did think it was interesting, you know, how he talked about the basically the two huge defining moments of his career happened within the first 3 years of when he was in the major leagues. And the first was when he was at the Baseball Writers Association, and he was at the table with Rachel Robinson, yeah. Jackie's wife. So, and he was there for like 3 hours at the table with her as a rookie, waiting to get the Rookie of the Year award, and just sitting and talking with her. And he said that he could not remember basically any of the conversation, just the fact that he was there with her and talking with her, and that 3 hours with her was some of the most memorable time.
Well, before you get to the second one, but that strikes me as like, you know, Jeter's biracial. Jackie Robinson, obviously, we know, broke the color barrier. Jeter was never political. And I just wonder... You know, in this post-George Floyd world where everyone seems to be socially active, do you think he would have been?
Given his personality, I don't think so.
Would he have gotten heat for that? Would he have gotten heat for it?
I don't think so, because he was such a master of not getting any heat in general. Not that he warranted the heat, but I think
he stayed out of the fray. He didn't comment on stuff.
Exactly. So, I mean, he was so on brand all the time that it was just like, you know... I don't ever see him, if the opportunity arose playing nowadays, I don't see how it would ever come his way. It was like almost one of those things where people would just be like, why even ask the guy? Like, it's not even worth it, you know?
I just wonder if there would be more of a clamor for him to be involved, at like a la LeBron. You know,
it could be.
I don't know, but I think that it's consistent with...
I'm sure there would have been a clamor, given his biracial status too, which is, you know, would have been huge. But, you know, again, I just don't see Derek Jeter as being the person for that platform.
He was so calculated, and I've said this before on the podcast. I mean, just the sheer fact that he was smart enough, honestly, and it sounds weird, not to get married. And it's not like... Relationships are great and they can root you and bring you to greatness. But I also think that how many superstars get divorced or have some marriage of convenience? And he took it out of the equation.
Or just a distraction in general. Not that getting married is a bad thing, but if you're trying to play a professional sport and you're getting married, next thing comes a family, right? So that is not an easy thing to juggle.
Right.
Regardless how much money you got, how many nannies you got, and how many chefs you got.
But I think it showed how calculated he was
about
his career.
Exactly.
Well, go ahead.
The other one I was going to say that he had talked about, huge defining moment, was 99 All-Star Game at Fenway, where Ted Williams was
in the wheelchair and everyone came out.
Ted Williams the first pitch, right? And everyone was gathered around, and Derek said he was, you know, kind of hanging in the back, and he felt a tap on his shoulder, and he looked, turned around, and it was Hank Aaron saying, I wanted to meet you.
Hank Aaron said that to him.
Yeah. Yeah. So can you imagine yourself being 3 years into the league? Right. Now, he's got three World Series championships. Well, he's going for his third.
Right.
Oh, he's got three, going for his fourth. But still, like Hank Aaron is tapping you on the shoulder and you've got 3 years in the league and he wants to meet you.
That's wild. No, wait. So they won three in the 90s. And
96,
one in the
98, 99.
Right. And then one in, what was it?
2000. And then they were in the World Series in 2001, which we'll talk about. And then 2009.
And he was on that 09 team, so he won five.
Yep. One for each finger. Yogi's got 10. Yogi's got the most.
Wow. But I think that five in the modern era is more impressive.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Because, I mean, the Yogi era, they just, I don't know, it just, the spending was different. The cachet was different. It's just everything was different. But I just think, listen, I'll hand it to him. What I wanted to say about the Hall of Fame, though, we had Josh Rawich, the president of the Hall of Fame, on our morning show on WTIC in Connecticut. And he just talked about, you know, the grandeur of it. And I think that, when you see the Jeter inductions, you get it, right? I mean, you just like, it seems like a larger than life moment. And I think
it's
of
like
other
the Hank Aaron,
yeah,
the Cal Ripken.
It felt that way. Right. And I think it was really good.
It wasn't
good.
Like the Glavin, Maddox. Like it was, you know, Griffey was another one.
Yeah.
What was funny about Griffey, when Griffey went in, he went in with Piazza, right? And Griffey was, I believe, the highest ever draft pick to go in at number one overall.
Really? No other number one overall pick had ever made the Hall of Fame.
Number one overall.
Right.
Right? I think Chipper Jones afterwards got in. He was a first rounder. There was a few others.
Right. So Griffey was first pick, first round.
Right.
Yeah.
Grant. Now listen to this though. When he goes in, Piazza goes in with him, and Piazza was like the last pick.
Yeah.
Like the last pick in the draft as like a compensation for Tommy Lasorda.
No, Lasorda did his dad. Lasorda knew his dad,
like his godfather or something like that.
And
so
he
like think
him.
About that. Those two guys going at the same time, like the most complete spectrum. Opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, one has this incredible pedigree who was just said, here's the door, go in the clubhouse. And Piazza literally was drafted as a favor. And nobody thought he had a prayer. I mean, I don't even, back then the baseball draft was like a gazillion rounds.
Rounds. He was like the 162nd round or something.
It was just like nuts.
Insane.
I encourage people to Google his appearance on Howard Stern years and years ago when he started to hit it big with the Mets, his backstory on it. And listen, I'm sure he did PEDs. I mean, I'm sure that he did.
Did his name come up? Like, there was sniffing about it.
I think
it.
He did. But you know what? Either way, everybody was doing it. So, like, it's not a judgment call. But I do think that, you know, even if you do them, it doesn't help you hit the ball. It helps you hit the ball farther.
Right.
So I think he had the talent all along, and he just
steroids doesn't put you in the Hall of Fame.
No, I don't think it does. But there's
plenty of players out there that did steroids that,
and did,
that washed
even
out
close,
in two
I know.
Or 3 years.
But my point is, Piazza, you know, talked about why it kicked in with him to the drive to make it when nobody thought he could. And those are the stories that I absolutely love. Whereas, you know, Jeter was just this incredible athlete all the way through. But I think it's his demeanor that I criticize that also is what made him great, which is, I think, is essentially, you know, your point. He's John Senecal. I'm Brian Shackman. This is Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports, episode 46. All right, let's break it down to what's going on now, because I can basically say, you know, when we record, I try not to get into specifics because I want these podcasts to, you know, to last. And I think that it's basically safe to say that there are four or five teams. I mean, I think that you consider the A's still in it, and they're still in it. But when I look at schedules and momentum, I really think the Mariners, Blue Jays, Yankees, and Red Sox. I think there is a scenario that has the Yankees and Red Sox missing the playoffs. I mean, I think they both, in all honesty, could get bounced. But I do think I want to say about the Red Sox, you know, whether they're in the first wild card, second wild card, or whatever, I think that once they get their COVID folks back, you know, like Bogarts, and their schedule, I actually think they're set up pretty well.
Yeah, when they come back from the COVID and the team's clicking, right? They're not clicking.
Well, they lost. They lost a series to Tampa, but no one's going to beat Tampa anyway.
No one's going to beat Tampa, right? We know that. And the Red Sox are playing better than they were when we talked last, right? So they have a legit shot. The Yankees have a legit shot, even though they're not playing good. Right now, the Yankees and Red Sox sit as the two teams. But listen, the way Toronto's playing and the way Toronto hits and the lineup that they have, the pitching has to be mediocre. It's like we talked about the Red Sox going through the season. The pitching had to be mediocre, right? And the thing is, if the Blue Jays keep hitting the way they do and they get into the playoffs, they can knock anybody around. Those guys can flat out hit.
I actually think they can beat Tampa.
Yes.
I mean, I really do think they can. Whereas I know the Red Sox can't beat Tampa in a seven game. Well, I can't
say Toronto has six more games against Tampa.
Yeah.
Six more games, right?
But I actually think that's good for the Yankees and the Red Sox.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
I really think that.
Well, sat and watched Tampa and the Red Sox beat on each other, and I'm just sitting there thinking, all you got to do is win. Just win.
Right.
Win a damn game, and something good is going to happen for you. And I'm just sitting, all right, they're going to win tomorrow. No, they're not. All right, they're going to win tomorrow. No, they're not. It's like unreal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we learned this week, and we sort of go week to week, is that the Yankees and the Red Sox are really flawed. I mean, they're not great baseball teams, and I think it's just.
But with the Yankees, it's like, who's going to be the flaw next? I feel like is the manager going to screw it up? Is the shortstop going to screw it up?
Right, and then
the guy in the second hole that's batting .062
or Aaron Judge, who you're talking about for MVP, who all of a sudden can't hit?
Right, exactly. It's like, what's going to happen next? And it's like, I don't get it. And it's weird because I feel like the Yankees went against everything that was working for them, and it started screwing them up, and then it just cascades into everything else. Like, they're not trying to steal bases. It's just whatever.
So, I mean, basically.
And Gerrit Cole's hurt, too.
I think they'll manage him well enough, and he'll be okay.
Like, listen, here's my take on that. If you caught it in time or whatever, what was he even out there pitching if you had some sort of inkling that the guy was hurt? He clearly wasn't on from the first pitch.
So you think he tweaked it even before he...
I wouldn't think that he went out there and did something the first inning like, oh, don't worry about it, Garrett, just see how it goes, right? I feel, again, like the Yankees, like some of the decisions they make are just plain out stupid. Like if Garrett Cole has any sort of injury,
they're done
before the game.
Right.
Like, why would you even put him out there? Like, maybe he's like, oh, I'm fine. Well, it's Garrett Cole. I don't know. I just don't get it. Like, if he's going to miss at least one start, like I said to you, like, oh, it's not a big deal. Like, he went out the game yesterday, right? He went out of the game. So there, right there is an impact. If he misses his next start, that's another impact for you.
Sure. It affects
the
team.
And how many more starts do you have left? Three?
Yeah, not many. So if I were to handicap it today, Yankees, Red Sox, in or out? We know our hot takes.
The way the Yankees are playing right now, out.
Really?
The way they're playing now, yes, with like 23 games, 20 games left. Everybody's basically got 20 games left, right. Say.
So basically,
you're not catching Tampa. It's the wild card hunt.
Yep.
And you're playing like crap, and you got to play good teams. Right, Boston has a little bit favorable schedule, but they still got to play the Yankees three more times.
Right.
They got to play what? They got to play...
the Yankee series.
Chicago, Seattle, Baltimore, the Mets, who won't go away. But they also have four off days, so the schedule does favor Boston.
Those late...
the West Coast swing a little bit.
That weekend series with the Yankees is going to be something.
Any Yankee fan that's watching the Yankees play right now and thinks they have a legit shot...
it's
of
so
making
funny,
the playoffs. It's crazy.
It's so funny, though. It vacillates so quickly.
It's, I mean,
2 weeks ago, we had the nail in the coffin. A week ago, they're going to the World Series. And now, all of a sudden, you think that they're done.
I don't think we ever thought they were going to the World Series.
I know, as far as
can they beat Tampa?
Right.
So we all know.
Matt Soroy is the producer who helps produce the show, thought that they could. I remember Matt saying
it was a four-game stretch.
Matt, he was like scratching his head. He's like, yeah, I'm not writing off them catching Tampa.
Four games with like 30-something left.
That was doable, but now it's not doable.
No, it's definitely not doable.
He's John Senecal. I'm Brian Shackman. This is Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. I want to talk about September 11th and just first... sort of describe your experience. You were a cameraman, videographer for NBC Connecticut, which is based in Hartford County, which is not close to New York. It's not Fairfield County, which is right over the border. But there were moments in your career where you had to drive down anyway. Just take me through your day, and then we'll talk about the World Series.
So that morning, I'm out. I think it was changing the oil on my truck. And we get a phone call from my wife, and she's like, a plane hit the World Trade Center. Now, I remember like probably like a few weeks before, I think like did somebody like a plane flew into a building in New York, or someone flew into the Statue of Liberty on like a paraglider or something like that.
Right.
And I was like, oh, no, it's just probably like, you know,
small and hokey and whatever.
Yeah, like whatever. And so I went back to doing what I was doing, and like she called back and she's like, no, I think it's really bad. You should go in and like check out the news. And like literally like right as she said that, my pager goes on. I mean, we still had pagers, dude. Right, still had pagers for the news. They would page you with like
you clipping it on, you take it off the belt.
Yeah,
it was
pre-BlackBerry.
I remember Brad Drazen was the first guy to have one, like 2 years later.
Pre-BlackBerry, yeah. Right? Still had like the phone connected in the car.
Yeah.
All right. So pager goes off, and it's like call newsroom ASAP. So like me being all dumb and like I had to work nights that day, and me and two of the other guys that worked at the station, we were gonna play some wiffle ball. So I was like, I call them and I'm like, oh, what's going on? They're like, oh, you know, there's a plane hit the World Trade Center.
What were you, like 25?
Yeah, like 25. Yeah. And I had just started. I've been a year there. And they're like, oh, a plane hit the World Trade Center. And the second plane hadn't hit yet. And I'm like, well, you know, I got some stuff going on, you know, to do. And they're like, no, you got to come in. And I was like, all right, this is obviously something big. So get my stuff together, going to work. And by then, the next plane had hit. And my assignment when I got there was to go to Bridgeport and as far down as we could go and get people that are coming out of New York City on the train.
Right.
Whoever's trying to get out of there. So we go to Bridgeport and... we're there with like literally every station, you know, CBS, I'm NBC, CBS, ABC, there's probably like, you know, like Fox is there. And the first train from New York gets out and you could tell like there's definitely some people that have been like, they got this like soot on them and, you know, whatever. And this one guy comes out, his name's Jimmy Vesquenza. And he was working on the 22nd floor, I believe, on Tower 1.
So he got out.
And he worked for MetLife, I believe. No, Blue Cross Blue Shield. on the 22nd floor, I believe. And he came off the train, and his parents met him there. And it was his, like, his mom, his dad, like his sister. Like, these people obviously were probably freaking out, right? So they race to the train station in Bridgeport, and they're meeting him there. And we want to interview him. So, of course, we jump all over this guy. And we're like, every news crew is talking to him, and he just wants to walk. He's just walking with his family. So we start doing what we call a perp walk, right?
You're chasing him down.
Well, I'm in front of him, right?
Right.
Some people are chasing him. I'm in front of him, right? Because I got the skills, Brian. Right. I'm a young gun, 25, coming from Rochester, New York. I'm ready to rock. Right.
You're flicking that camera around.
Flicking that camera over my shoulder. I'm ready to go. So, which is crazy, though, because this is one of the big things I remember about that day for me. Was like literally I walked backwards, and I have the video. I have it all on video. I post it every year to remember. I went like a good two blocks walking backwards with this guy and didn't drop. And it's crazy. Like, you can hear the other camera people hitting things and banging into posts and all that.
But who's your reporter?
Bob Wilson.
Okay.
Bob Wilson.
Who's now at TNH.
TNH, yep.
In New Haven.
Yeah. So Jimmy Vasquenza, and I can remember this guy's voice like it's yesterday. Company something, freaking heroes, he kept saying. There was no fear in these guys' eyes. They went right up by me on the stairs.
Firefighters.
Yeah. So maybe some of those guys probably maybe never made it out, but you could literally see and hear this guy's voice was just and this is after a ride from the city up to Bridgeport.
But we had time to settle down.
Right?
Yeah.
Plenty of time to kind of settle down, but he just completely scared out of his mind, talking about burning bodies falling out of the building and hitting the top as he's walking out and the atrium and all this stuff. And I had my stepbrothers work down there too at the time in the World Trade Center, and they told me the same stories. And, you know, one of them saw the bodies falling, and he just took off running as far as he could run finally. And then he just finally got he didn't realize he was 3 miles away. But anyway, so we go after Bridgeport. We were going to the city.
Oh, could you get in?
So we drove the news car as far as we could get. To one of the subway stations north of the city, and I can't even remember what street it was. But we basically just pulled the news car over, and I'm like, let's just try this station. The train.
Did you get
still
to 125th, with the
something,
Bronx,
and just left the news car there. Obviously, there's nobody coming to ticket your car. Like, they got bigger things to do.
Right.
So we get on the train and we go down, and we get into the city as far as we could go, and we get out. And first thing I just remember is walking out and seeing just rows and rows of just buses lined up.
To evacuate people?
To rotate workers or take people out. I don't know. Whatever it was just weird, right? So by that time, it's getting towards the afternoon, and we're getting down. And
were you trying to get to Ground Zero?
As far as we could go, right? As far as we could get down there. And we're walking, and you can see the soot just get deeper and deeper and deeper as you're going. And the other thing I remember is just women's shoes everywhere. High heel shoes everywhere.
Really?
Because they just kicked
them off and ran.
Just to run. You know, when those buildings fell, you got to remember at the time, it's not now. We had no freaking clue what was going on to us. To us, it was just something happened. It wasn't if this happened now, dude, people would be crawling into their basements and hunker down waiting for the end of the world. The magnitude of, if you reflect back on the magnitude of the situation at the time, that we really had no clue of what we were about to get into.
Right.
Think about that happening now. I would literally think that the world is going to end.
Right.
Nukes are going to start flying.
Right.
You know, but getting back to the vivid memories of that. And then as the night fell and you're walking and we're trying to get closer. And all of a sudden a spotlight would hit you and be wrong way. And it'd be the cops with their machine guns. You can't be here. You can't be here. So at one point we wind up in the back of an AMR ambulance. This is just crazy, right? I don't know how this happens. But
was there a victim in the ambulance?
No, we're just trying to get as far as we can up. This is just it's news, dude. It's cutthroat.
Did you go live from down there?
No.
No.
There was no live down there.
Because you couldn't get a signal.
First of all, we're NBC Connecticut, you know. You can say you're an O&O all you want, but when something
owned
like that happens.
For people who don't know, owned and operated, owned by
so
NBC.
So we're owned by NBC, which is also owned WNBC New York, right. Chicago, LA. The same people that signed the big people's checks signed our checks, right? So you think you got some cred, but when you roll into a situation like that,
you're the last
priority. Exactly. Your cred falls out the window.
So you had to gather material and bring it back.
WNBC. Okay. So we did wind up back at WNBC, but this is the time when you're hauling. This is not your cell phone era.
Right. You have heavy equipment.
Heavy equipment. So I'm just basically rolling in there with a camera, no tripod, just shooting from the hip, hoping my batteries don't die.
Right.
Which, you know, at that
always
time,
happens.
Always happens. The batteries weighed half as much as the camera. You got them looped around your waist. It's just like, it's nothing like you have now. If we rolled in there now, first of all, I wouldn't even go there because I'd just be jacking stuff off the internet that people were putting up from the scene. Right. So we end up in the back of this AMR ambulance and we're going over the fire hoses. That's what I remember. Just driving over fire hoses down these streets.
Thank God, it's not because, bodies or something.
And we're looking, no, definitely not bodies. So I'm looking out the front of this ambulance and it's just, you can just tell we're just not in an area we need to be in. Right. And you could see like I call it the pitchforks, the pillars of the, you know, the symbolic sides of the thing. And then I'm just like, this is not good. I don't know why we're down here. Like, we have literally, like, we're not going down there. Like, somehow we just...
We're driving.
Bribed into this ambulance. Yeah. We worked our way into it, you know? Like, con these people to take us down there. And at one point, I look over, and they stop. And there's this person's talking to him. And I look out the side, and it's like this dude with, like, the longest rifle and machine gun I've ever seen in my life, and tactical gear and all that. And at that point, I'm thinking, all right... So if this guy comes into this truck, he's not asking like, who are you, what you're doing. He's like, either it's going to be like, I'm getting choked out. Something good's not going to happen. Right. Like, there's no reason for me to be down there. Right. You know what I mean? There's no reason for us to be
down
there.
But you're being a journalist. That's your job.
Right. So at that point, like, I think it was just like, they told us to turn around and I was all for that. And we went back out. So then now we're on the sidewalk, right? In the middle of
Manhattan.
Right. And now we got to find our way back to WNBC.
There's no public transit.
No public transportation. I could still remember like literally standing in the middle of like Fifth Avenue. And like you could have laid down in it, dude.
Nothing.
You could have laid down in it, fallen asleep, and nothing. Nothing would have happened. And then everywhere you looked, there was just cases and cases and cases of water and women's shoes and soot. It was crazy. It was crazy.
So let's transition. John Senecal here, Brian Shackman, fan base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports, talking about his reflections on 9/11. The reason I bring it up, not only is it such a unique experience that very few people had, John, is that then, what, you know, I don't know, 6 weeks or whatever, two months later, you're trying to cover the World Series between the Arizona Diamondbacks and the New York Yankees, and... Because of security, you couldn't even get
into the stadium. Back to the cred thing, right? Like, they literally had, like, the MLB crew that was in there. And then, like, just one rep from WABC was probably, like, Bruce Beck.
Yeah.
And then one rep from, like...
The other stations.
And I believe, like, you know, this is... NBC might have... I think it was on Fox by then.
Yeah, I think it had already...
So anyways, yeah. So the best we could do was outside. So our angle was, let's do a piece on the fans coming back, the security, because that was the game President Bush was going to throw out the first pitch.
Which was one of the best pitches.
Crazy,
first
right?
Pitches
so
ever.
Like, they had, I think it was three different Marine Ones flew in over the stadium and landed as decoys. Who didn't know which one he was in. So if anybody had been to a baseball game pre-9/11, you know, you could walk right in. Heck, you could get on an airplane 15 minutes before you got off, the flight took off.
Totally.
Now, granted, people might feel a little bit more hesitant, you know, and apprehensive to go into thing after 9/11. But if you would have saw the security that was to get into the Yankee Stadium at that point, between the dogs, the metal detectors, you know, the so-called sky radars and all this other stuff that they were pushing on you that they said they had, and narcs here and there. But listen, if you got into that stadium,
you had nothing on you.
and you could pick off the president that day, then you were the most inside job on the planet.
Because I did the Olympics in Salt Lake in 02, which wasn't
which
even
was
New York.
Which was huge security.
Which was like...
Everyone thought that was going to be the next big...
Right. So I can't imagine what it was like in New York, you know, 2 months after 9/11 with the president in attendance. I covered
that with Kevin Nathan. We went down. It's still one of the most memorable stories that we did. You know, and we never even got in the stadium. And I've been to plenty of playoff games, and I was at the Subway Series. And it was just the fact that, like, A, you were there to say you were there. B, just to see, like, the difference.
Right.
You know, going to a place that you literally, like, if you're a Yankees fan, you've been there enough, like, you know it, like, by the back of your hand. It's like walking into your house and going through, like, 17 layers of people asking you what you're going to go in there for or whatever.
Right. So let me ask you in closing, how disappointing, you know, because we've talked about this. I talked about this on the morning show on WTIC about how even I was sort of cheering for the Yankees. And I'm just curious, how much of a bummer was it that they didn't win it?
It was a total bummer. You know, if you remember back the series, I mean, they were down the whole time in that series, and they kept coming back, and it was just like the whole fighting spirit in New York rise from the ashes, and then they go and listen. You know, obviously, you can say all you want if Jeter was playing back and the infield wasn't in, you catch the ball and where does it go? You can speculate forever, but the grand scheme of things is they lost. And yes, totally disappointed. I can still remember my wife and I were sitting in our condo in Bristol, and we had New York, New York queued up on our DVD, CD player.
Nice.
We had it queued up, and then I think it was like Womack got a hit or something. Rivera threw the ball away, and she's like, they can still win. I'm like, I looked at her, I'm like, there is no possible way they are going to win this game right now. And I just remember just walking away, and that was it. But yeah, total.
It just wasn't the storybook ending.
It definitely wasn't.
And a lot of people wanted that for the country.
It was almost like the Diamondbacks felt bad.
Bad for the Diamondbacks because like it's this pinnacle of your life, and I felt like they couldn't celebrate it the way it should have been celebrated because it was that context.
That's like the one storybook ending Jeter wasn't part of.
Right. Hey, tell me this. So is your nugget this week, is it 9/11 related?
No. It's actually Jeter Hall of Fame related.
Okay, what do you got?
All right, so Jeter does his Hall of Fame speech, and he thanks the players, right? And he thanks Posada, I think like Pettit.
Sure.
Like the core four. And the first person he mentions was Gerald Williams.
So Gerald Williams, not Bernie.
Not Bernie Williams. So a lot of people were like, well, who's
Gerald Williams.
Exactly. So a lot of people say, well, who's Gerald Williams, right?
Well, is Gerald Williams?
Gerald Williams is from Laplace, Louisiana. He went to East St. John's High School with Bobby Dickerson. They graduated together. Bobby and Gerald are like really good friends. Huh. So that's how I met Gerald Williams, was through Bobby. But not Gerald and Bobby actually played together in Albany in 1990. And that's how I like officially met Gerald. Now, Gerald wound up being in Bobby's wedding. And I think Bobby got married in like 1990.
And you went to that wedding.
And I was in Bobby's wedding as one of like the ushers. So it was like me, Gerald, some of Bobby's high school.
Repeat to people, you met Dickerson going to minor league games. And you end up with a friendship that ended up with him in your wedding. That's just amazing.
Yeah, and his wedding. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. With Gerald Williams. Now, like, people wouldn't think, like, Gerald Williams a household name, right? Like, now, if you look back at, like, I want to say it was in 96 or 98. When did Doc Gooden throw his no-hitter?
No idea.
Saved his no-hitter. Now, he wound up getting traded for, I think it was for Graham Lloyd to the...
Graham Lloyd.
So it must have been 96 or 98. To the Brewers. And he didn't wind up getting a World Series ring that year. And I know he was definitely bitter about that. And he got traded pretty late in the season. And he was a big part of that season. But Gerald Williams was an excellent baseball player. And his nickname was Ice because he was so cool. And I'll tell you something. When they say Ice, like, it's like the dude has like, he never sweat. He would never sweat. Like, I remember hanging out with him down in Louisiana. And I was like in high school. I think I was like a senior in high school in the offseason. And a dude was like dunking on me in Bobby's parents' driveway, like a ghetto hoops.
Right.
And it's like it was nothing, like at a 10-foot hoop.
He's just a great athlete.
Just a great athlete.
So what's the nugget?
And then I remember watching him take batting practice on the field, like in a cage and like the poles on the thing. He would say, "What pole do you want me to hit?" And he would hit the poles. Unbelievable.
On call, on cue.
On cue. Second one, third one. And that's Gerald Williams, right. Dude.
Just right? Shows you what the big dogs really can do.
What the big dogs really can do. No, that's my nugget. Derek Jeter, into the Hall of Fame, thanks Gerald Williams, who's one of his best friends. Now, they must have met at Derek Jeter's first spring training in 92 because Gerald...
was on his way out, right?
Was on his way out. And they, well, in the minor leagues, they never really played with each other, right? Because Derek was just coming in and Gerald had already been in a couple of years, so they weren't at the same level. By the time they, you know, so
was he some sort of mentor type thing?
Must have been.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to, I actually would be fun to ask Jeter about that and why he thanked him first. I mean, I'm sure the asks will be out in tenfold.
I talked to Bobby when I was down in Miami, right, when they were playing Miami, San Diego, and he said he's going to come on the show with us after the season. Good. But I also talked to him about trying to get Gerald on the show, and he said Gerald's a very big introvert, and he's not a big talker. Oh, so, funny. But hey, you never know.
I really appreciate the insight on Jeter and 9/11 and that stuff. It's just... you know, really important baseball lover stuff. And so we'll be back with episode 47 next week with a special guest, for both of us, it's going to be hysterical. At least I hope it's going
to
be hysterical.
And he's going to have some Jeter stuff to talk about.
Yeah, it's going to make me nauseous. But we'll reveal that next week. In the meantime, obviously enjoy this podcast wherever you're enjoying it now. Like it, share it. This has been episode 46 of Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
Hey, this is Richard Deitch, the host of the Sports Media Podcast. If you're interested in what's happening with all the places where you consume sports, the Sports Media Podcast has you covered.
I've been turning down interviews all week. Hoda Kotb reached out, Oprah, George Stephanopoulos. So I said no. I was booked on the Deitch Podcast before the Taylor Swift phenomenon. I must live up to my responsibility.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.